Welcome to another episode of the High Performance Arsenal Podcast, a podcast where we discuss how sport and exercise psychology can help us become the best versions of ourselves. My guest for today is Dr. Jasmine Hutchinson. Dr. Hutchinson is the Director of Graduate Studies in Sport and Exercise Psychology at Springfield College in Massachusetts. She's also a certified mental performance consultant and a certified exercise physiologist. And when it comes to any sort of research related to performance and music, she's the real deal. Not only that, she's also someone who practices what she preaches. Having done her fair share of half marathons, marathons, 10Ks, 5Ks, etc. I've gone to her office and it's just medals from all the races she's finished. For our conversation today, we talk about everything related to music and performance. Before we got into the specifics of protocols, we just spoke about music in general. We started by talking about how music helps us form a sense of identity. Dr. Hutchinson also talked about her love for Taylor Swift. That's right, she's also a Swiftie. Then we talked about how music can affect our emotions and behaviors, and how music composers take advantage of this and have us feel and act a certain way. Then we talk about how you can harness the power of music to enhance your performance. We go over protocols for cardio and resistance training exercises. If you're a personal trainer, we also talk about how you can craft the perfect playlist to give your clients the best workout possible. Then we briefly go over how you can start thinking like a scientist. We talk about how you can take these protocols, start putting them into your life, and experimenting with them so that you can find out exactly what works for you. I hope you enjoy listening to this podcast just as much as I enjoyed making it. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Jasmine Hutchinson.
About music, I don't think any conversation about music can really go forward without asking the other person who their favorite artist is. And here's the thing, I was gonna ask you, but then I got an inside source who I won't name who told me that your favorite artist is Taylor Swift. I wanted to ask you if that's true.
Okay, so there's a whole backstory to that, which is I liked Taylor Swift before she was super mainstream, so now I almost don't want to tell people that because I'm like, dude, I've been a Swiftie from the beginning, like back off, you know? So I don't want it to seem like I'm a recent Swiftie. But yeah, it's also a thing that me and my daughter do together. So she got into Taylor Swift and she was young. I think the first concert I took her to was 1989. And I think she was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And so it's always been our thing on road trips. When we drive on road trips, it still is to this day. We crank the Taylor Swift and we analyze the lyrics to death. So
yeah,
that would probably be my favorite artist.
Okay, so then you are confirmed an OG Taylor Swift fan.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious, what's your favorite Taylor Swift song?
Oh man.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, so many of these, even favorite artists, it totally depends on my mood and who I'm with. But I'm probably going to have to say All Too Well, which again is a very mainstream answer. But you know, it's mainstream for a reason. It's an amazing, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's good for a reason. For me, I haven't listened. Obviously, I can't say this out loud. I haven't listened to many of her new stuff, but that's because I like her old stuff. Like one of my favorite all-time songs is Love Story by Taylor Swift. Great song. And
so
when we had done a karaoke night at the start of the semester with the cohort, we were all trying to get to know each other. We went to Patty's and that was a song I had chosen. And again, these are people that have known me for probably 3 days and to see me go up and sing It's a Love Story, it brought us all very closer together.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. And it's one of those songs too, that where you can really like chant it together, you know. It's a song that works well. Like I've seen her do that in concert and the whole crowd, you know, gives the marry me Juliet and everyone kind of bounces. It's a great one.
You'd mention that's the best part about music. I think people take it for granted so much that they don't really understand the powers, or at least all the things that come along with listening to music. And we spoke of concerts, and I think that's a really great example of how music brings people together. And when I was preparing for this podcast, I started thinking about, I've only been to one concert in my life and it was a Green Day concert. I don't know if you've heard of the band Green Day. It holds a special place in my heart. When I moved to the US, the first few songs that I listened to in English were from Green Day. So when I went to that, I didn't expect myself to be so taken up by emotions, because it wasn't just me enjoying the music and I knew all the words to all their songs. Everyone did inside the stadium.
Yeah.
And it made me feel like, wow, I don't know this person 7 rows down from me, but me and him, we really love like this song and this band. And it made you feel like a part of something bigger.
And absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's it has that. There's so many levels to that social connection that we get through music. One is, yeah, it's the shared experience, right? And so, especially when the lyrics mean something to you, you're like, oh, you've been through that too, you know, like it makes you feel less alone. But then also just having a shared rhythm and the crowd kind of moving together, I think there's probably beyond my scope, but some very evolutionarily powerful thing to synchronize movement. If you think about like, how armies march together, or even sort of tribal and marching into battle and things like that. So there's something about being synchronized with other people too. So there's both of those elements together. Yeah, you identify, you feel part of a collective, but then also you're like identify that, oh, this means something to other people. It makes you feel like a sense of belonging. So,
yeah. I never had considered how music is used to, I guess, like, you'd mentioned like to keep everyone in rhythm, and you use a military example. It'd be cool to listen to a drummer, because I mean, in a band, that's their whole goal, is to unify everyone with a single beat. And that's a nice
Everybody says the drummer is the most important person in a band, because they keep everybody else together. Yeah. Which is funny, because you always think like the lead singer, right? You know, because often bands have very charismatic lead singers that you don't take your eye off. But yeah, really, it's all about the drummer. So.
That's fascinating. See, in life, it's all about the music, because that's what it does for us.
Yeah.
The tone and the identity. So when I was looking into this, another thing that had come up to me is how it not only crafts like a sense of identity, but it also songs create culture. Like, I mean, we have national anthems, right? It's not just this thing we read off, we sing it, because it makes us, it invokes a sense of pride. And another thing that I thought about was like, songs in sports, right? Because this is sport focused, we're performance focused, and I know that you're a Liverpool fan. So my roommate, he's a huge soccer fan, he's from the UK, and he would always show me these videos of fans, especially Liverpool fans, singing songs, whether it's when they won, when they lost, or if they wanted to get into the head of the athlete.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, could you talk a little bit more about the culture of singing songs in soccer and at Liverpool and your experience with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one, it speaks to like that collective experience we were just talking about. And you certainly get that within the fandom, right? You're like, you're willing to die for these, you know, like this is my team. And, you know, so you certainly get that collective experience. And there's something as well about what, so when it's a particular song like that, the number of voices. So I've been fortunate enough to be at Anfield when they sing their sort of like the main Liverpool song, which is You'll Never Walk Alone. And there's something like 50, 60,000 people all singing the same song. It's just so stirring, you know? And then I think as well, it's kind of, it speaks to the city as well and the shared experiences of the club. So we sang this song in good times and bad. And so, you know, it sort of is like, yeah, it's a very unifying experience. And in a way, sport to me is almost like the modern day sort of warfare or gladiatorial, you know, combat, right? Because you just think about how tribal it is. You wear your colors, right? So we're in red and then the other team are like, say, are in blue, and paint your face and all of those things. I think it's almost, it probably does throw back to some of those sort of Roman Empire type stuff, but it's just now in a more socially acceptable form. And so, but yeah, it's just about that shared emotion, and kind of like how you explained at Green Day, you're like, oh, I don't know this guy, but he supports Liverpool too, so we're friends, you know, we're together in this. So, but yeah, some amazing songs.
do you have a favorite? Because I know there's quite a few.
So obviously with Liverpool, I think it's always going to be You'll Never Walk Alone. It's the song that we're known for. The lyrics are very meaningful. But there's some others as well that they're for particular players. So and what I think Liverpool do, I'm biased, of course, but what I think Liverpool tend to do better than anybody else, I think, is we come up with songs where it's a fairly well-known song, and then we get the person's name in it. So there's one that it goes to the tune of Dirty Old Town. I think it's by the Pogues, but it's Virgil van Dijk. So we'll sing, he's Virgil van Dijk, you know, and it kind of goes to the tune. Another one is for Mo Salah, and it's in the, it goes to the tune of Sit Down by the band James, which were a big British band probably 20 years ago. And so, yeah, those are really a way to connect with the athletes as well, and a way to show support. But those can be really funny. So I've got a few favorites of those as well.
That's amazing. That's something I really hope that English sports, or I guess not English sports, American sports pick up, because we do have songs whenever the team scores a touchdown, but it's never really the same. I've never had the opportunity to go to a soccer game or a football match.
Yeah, it's amazing. And what as well, I think is, so yeah, American sports, what they do really well is kind of like the walkout song, or yeah, the song that's associated with a touchdown or a three pointer or whatever it might be. They do that really well, but that's almost always recorded. And so I think what you get differently in England is the singing of it, you know? And I think the other thing that I often wonder is how songs used to spread before the days of social media, because especially those ones that are about players, they come and go because players come and go, right? So we get a new player and then all of a sudden he has a song, and it's like, well, who came up with this song and how did they teach everybody the words, you know? Yeah. And so it's a sort of that old fashioned, like the game of telephone, I guess. Somebody sings it and then somebody else sings it, and next thing you know, the whole stadium's singing it. But now they record it and you'll see it on Twitter or something. But yeah, previously it was I'm like, how did this spread? I don't know.
If you've seen, have you seen Ted Lasso?
Yeah, yeah.
I have this image from the show. There's these fans that they always follow the team, and they're always at the bar watching the game. So I'd always wondered, right? Like, how do these songs come up? I just have this image of just some guy at a pub who just started singing. And I was like, hey, that is really good. And then it just picks up from there.
I think that's exactly how it starts. There's definitely beer involved, definitely, because they're very creative and they're very funny. But maybe a couple of guys sing it in the pub, and then the, you know, all the guys from the pub go to the stadium, and then, you know, people in the stadium hear it. And it's definitely a cultural phenomenon. It'd be worth studying.
Yeah. So you had mentioned previously, like, when you're singing with these songs, you'd use a word that I really like. You said stirring, right? It stirs up emotions in you, and it's an effective way of communicating how the crowd feels. And, you know, with music, some have called it a universal language. Mm-hmm. Where even if you don't have words, or if it does have words, doesn't matter where you're from, people understand, like, at the base level of emotions, whether it's happy, sad, angry, how that song is making them feel and what it's about. So I found this really cool study. And what they'd done was they brought together Western culture and Eastern culture Chinese individuals, and they brought a whole host of songs from each. I think it was about 64. And they had categories of happy, sad, tender, aggressive, and then danceability. And they played it for both sides. And what they had seen, that it evoked the same sort of emotions within them, despite the language differences between the two. Also, I think you'd be happy to know they added Shake It Off by Taylor Swift in the happy category for American songs.
Awesome.
And I think that's just really cool that you don't need to say words and don't need to know it, but it still brings forth the same feelings.
I guess that's true. It is the universal language, right? So, the one thing I do know about this, I don't know that particular study, but I do know that, like, the types of chords used, and I'm not a musician, as much as I love music, I don't play music, but generally speaking, major chords and major keys tend to produce sort of a light and happy sound, and minor chords and minor keys tend to be kind of dark and sad. And that as well, I've seen, is universal. So if you play those chords in different cultures and things like that, that people tend to identify them as happy and sad. And I don't honestly, because a lot of the ways that we know that music invokes emotions is with these cultural associations that we have with music. But yeah, in those cases where it's cross-cultural, you know, it must be something inherent in the elements of the song, and which pretty difficult to tease apart. But yeah, it's really interesting.
I definitely don't know the neuroscience behind it, but I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it's Andrew Huberman's, very popular, and he did an episode on music and motivation. What he said was, when music plays into our eardrums, I forgot how he phrased it, but the frequency of the music, our neurotransmitters and our neurons start firing at the same rate. So he phrased it essentially, you're not just listening to the music, you're not listening to the instrument, you also become the instrument. So in a major chord, whatever that frequency is,
feel
that, and it, which is just, again, I don't know the science, but even that thought intuitively makes sense, because that's just a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, that's a really interesting, that speaks to the embodiment of music, right? That it's the idea that it's embodied, that we feel it within ourselves. Yeah, the frequencies, because if you think about it, all music is sound, which is just waves, right? Which is kind of crazy when you think about how much music means to us. And it's just vibrations in the air. So yeah, it must be something to do with the vibrations associated with the major and minor keys and how our brain interprets them. That's amazing. And that's really, honestly, really cool.
The science behind it is nothing I know of, but it's something that people have intuitively known, because I mean, that's what composers do.
Right.
They essentially manipulate music to evoke certain emotions in us.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things, I have many geeky qualities. One of my favorite geeky quality about myself is I love instrumental music.
Yeah.
Like, I have multiple playlists where it's just all movie like soundtracks. Because they invoke certain feelings that are associated with certain movies.
Yeah.
So I was talking to one of my friends, and who's a musician now, and he teaches music. And he essentially says, like, that's how we teach it, where it's not just about the chords. How are you trying to get them to feel?
Yeah.
And there's this great video I saw. I'm assuming you've seen the movie Dunkirk.
Yep.
So the composer, Hans Zimmer, a very great composer.
Amazing.
Interstellar, Inception. And in the music, there's this video where in Dunkirk, he wanted to create this sense of tension and anxiety, because that's how they were feeling while they're stranded
right.
on these beaches trying to get back to England. So he used this technique with the beats where it sounded like a clock, and it was put together with like an ascending, like crescendoing tone of like, I think it was like a minor key. But he had somehow made it in a way where it just was like an endless ticking clock, where usually it's like tick, 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 and it gets louder and louder and it leads to something. But in the song, it was just endless. So it created this tension. So like if you look up YouTube and Dunkirk soundtrack, so he manipulates that because he wants to make you feel that way. And that blows my mind.
I'm definitely going to look that up. Yeah, Hans Zimmer is a genius. My husband loves him. So we have many playlists too with him. Did he do Gladiator too? That's an amazing soundtrack. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Bring some vocals into it too.
That's a really interesting thing, because it plays on our expectations, right? So I imagine, the idea that it doesn't get faster or louder or doesn't change, you know, is contrary to what we might imagine. Like, I'm thinking typically like how they build up tension in, like, let's say a horror movie. There's this build, quicker. And it kind of makes your heart rate go quicker, because you do have that synchronization, like your bodily system synchronized.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get that feeling of anxiety. It's very clever then to have something constant to really just show that the sense of waiting, right? Waiting. Yeah. I'll look that up. That's cool.
Absolutely. They're mass manipulators. And anyone listening, I'll make sure I'll put it in the show notes too at the bottom.
Cool.
And like you said, the body systems start aligning, where if you feel a certain way, your heart races and you want to act a certain way. If someone plays a really sad tune, you want to go and give someone a hug. If I was to pause this right now and play the theme song from Rocky, guaranteed it would come back on and we're both doing push-ups or something, because it gets you wanting to go. And I think that's the big thing about people, about music, that people don't really like appreciate, might not be the right word, but understand how to use, because they understand it evokes emotions, but they don't really see how we can create emotions too. Sometimes people listen to music because they're sad.
Yeah, but... so we call that an action tendency. Right? So music makes you want to move, and it can be slowly in the case of relaxing or classical music. So, you know, certainly if you want to slow down or if you wanted to relax, you'd listen to that and it would kind of lower your heart rate and your breathing rate and slow you down. But then, music that's upbeat or motivational in some way, it inspires us to want to move for sure. And that's really one of the big connections that it makes to physical activity, is that, it really kind of gets at a pretty visceral level. I think it stimulates, like, again, I'm not a neuroscientist, but the reticular activating system, which is sort of the arousal system of our brain. Again, it kind of fires and makes us want to, because if you think about it, like even just tapping your foot or tapping your finger to a song, sometimes you don't even realize you're doing it. You know, it's just, it's almost an instinct. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a perfect segue into the main topic of this conversation, right? Music and physical performance. And we'll continue down this path where I want to reference one of the studies that you've done where you looked at how music affected anaerobic activity. And for the non-science people, was it anaerobic or aerobic? Correct me wrong with the study.
It was anaerobic. Yeah. Anaerobic, yeah. It was an all out sprint. If anyone's familiar, it was a Wingate task, which is a very miserable 30-second sprint on a bike. Yeah. Horrible, horrible task.
Anaerobic, essentially for my non-science folks, that's where you're not using oxygen as a primary source of energy. So if you're doing a long run, that would be aerobic. Anaerobic, 30 seconds, you know, weightlifting would fall into that category. So you're really, really pushing all of your resources. So I'm curious, when you did the study, how was it set up with the Wingate? What did you do? What did you learn? And what was the purpose behind? What were you trying to find out through this process?
Great question. And actually, that I think that might have been one of my very first music-related studies. That was one of my early ones. And so, yeah, what we wanted to try to look at was, in that particular study, I was really interested in actually exploiting the idea of anticipation. And so I don't know if you're familiar with the song Sandstorm by Darude.
Yeah, great song.
Yeah.
It's a popular meme.
Right. There you go. Yeah. So I think most people will know it, but if not, look it up. It's so it has a real build to the start of it. Right. And it picks up and it gets faster and faster. And so what we had people do was they started to warm up and they started to accelerate into that sort of anticipatory part of the song. And then as the beat dropped, we actually dropped the weight on the bike. Because a Wingate is a resisted sprint. So you have to sprint against a percentage of your body weight. So when the weight engages, that's when it really is miserable, because you can spin without resistance pretty fast and it's no big deal. And so we really wanted to look in that particular study. I was interested because a lot of the research that have been done to date, and still the majority, looks at aerobic. And so sort of long distance running, cycling, walking, those kind of general tasks in which music can be extremely helpful. And I wanted to see how helpful it was in a different type of task. And it had some effects that we would expect. The biggest one, I think, that was different from other studies where you're in where it's a less intense activity, is that it didn't have an impact on perceived exertion. And normally music can help lower perceived exertion, but there is an upper limit to that effect. So during low to moderate exercise, anywhere up until and around the ventilatory threshold, you can sort of occupy attentional capacity. So music will have this dissociative effect where it might distract you from some of those exertive sensations. So kind of, you know, gasping for breath, or your legs are burning, or you're sweating. And so, you know, your brain, some of your attention is occupied by the music, so you pay less attention to those sensations, meaning that you tend to report that the exercise feels easier. In this particular study, music didn't have that effect, but I think that's because there's a certain level at which you can't tune out the sensations of exertion, and nor should you, because that is your body's way of telling you, hey, you know, we're not in homeostasis anymore. This is unsustainable. You need to stop, right? So when you're at very, very high exercise intensities, your body's not going to let you tune that out. Whereas if you're in a light jog, your mind is free to wander. So it did not have any effects on perceived exertion, but it did have a strong effect on motivation, as you might imagine. And then also, believe it or not, affect, which is sort of like the extent to which they liked or disliked the task. I don't honestly know that anybody liked it, but they disliked it less. and then, of course, it had the performance effect. And again, that was a little not straightforward, because it had it impacted peak power, which is sort of like the maximum power you can generate right at the start of the sprint.
Yeah.
But as the time of the Wingate goes, you know, obviously performance declines as you fatigue. And it did not really have a strong impact, if I remember correctly, on the rate of decline or mean power. So it really seemed to give you that initial burst. So your first 5 seconds on the task is usually where you hit peak power. That was greater in the music compared to the non-music condition. Yeah. But overall, by the end of the task, they were performing similarly. So again, I think at that level music is not going to offset something so, so difficult, but it definitely that initial push. And so if you're thinking about something like, let's say a 1RM attempt, which may literally only be about 5 seconds, right? Then I think you could certainly leverage that in that type of capacity. The other thing that we didn't look at, we did a single sprint, and I don't know whether if somebody were to do sort of like a set of sprint repeats, you know, like maybe on a track when you're running like 200 repeats or something, whether the music would have an effect in multiple sets or not. We didn't look at that, but that's another thing that could be of interest with that kind of thing.
I, as you were saying that, I actually essentially wrote that down where for sprinting. So whenever I would practice sprinting, which honestly is not one of my favorite tasks to do, because I prefer running at a very low pace, which is why I like endurance running. But whenever I used to do that, I would go on the track and I'll put on a song, but I wouldn't run. I would time up my rest for when the beat would drop, just like you did. Because then it just, it's like I would start, when you're sprinting, they always recommend your peak sprint comes in like after the first third. So you're just sort of warming up and then you go into that running start. So I'd always time it out about 10 seconds before, and then I would just, you know, start bouncing, and then, all right, here it comes in 10 seconds, get closer and closer, and then go all out. I don't know if it sustained my effort or reduced it, but like you said, it is so much more enjoyable because you feel like you're in the top of the world. It's like your own movie, and the music's crescendoing for you, and it adds to the whole effect of it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's almost like you're creating your own highlight reel, right?
And you'd mentioned one rep maxes, and there's this individual I follow him by the name of Bio Lane, and he's a PhD who looks more into exercise science, and he's also a powerlifter. And in his videos where he powerlifts or when he's competing, you'll see him like to come out on a deadlift, he'll come out from the back of the stage. Obviously, you know, he's very big and angry, so you know, he'll like slap his arms, but you hear like hard rock music playing in the back as he's walking out because he was listening to that in the other room. So the science, I don't know. And like you said, there's probably studies out there, but intuitively people have started using it. And I think that's the biggest key.
Yeah, but I know this was a few years back now, but I remember Michael Phelps was videoed and what, you know, getting ready for, I think it was the Olympics where he went for, I think he got like 5 gold medals, which was the record or something. I remember there was a lot of hype around him. And yeah, he always had his headphones on right up until the point pretty much he stepped out onto the pool deck. And I remember people asking him what he was listening to. And I should have looked it up so I could tell you with some authority, but I do not remember. But it was actually like a fairly, it was a slower rap song, which again, I think you got to think about. So when you're using music for motivational purposes, where do you want to go? So for him, he didn't necessarily want to come out smashing and do something like a 1RM, right? Yeah. So he, you know, you're at the Olympic Games in the final, he probably was actually looking to potentially bring down his arousal level. It was really interesting because I think a lot of people assumed he was listening to some kind of crazy fire up music, but it was actually I know the lyrics were very important to him. He spoke about them. It said something like I am the best or something. It was that kind of lyrical content, but the actual beat and tempo of the music was actually fairly slow, which I thought was pretty interesting.
That's really cool. I mean, that ties back to how sound makes you feel certain emotions. And you, I was going to also bring up that one of my favorite Formula One drivers is Daniel Ricciardo. If my camera had showed it, I have his jersey hanging up right here. And every time you watch before they get into the cars, he's always just dancing, doing a little groove because he's listening to groovy music. In Drive to Survive, all the athletes talk about they either listen to music or something before the race. But then what they do is to escape all the stuff surrounding the race and where they want to get into the zone, they block out all sounds. And the best way to do that is to put on their helmets. So sometimes like before they even get on and, you know, they're just sitting and waiting on the grid for the lights to go. And then they do their warm-up lap. Most of them are sitting in their car, you know, helmets on, the visor down, just to quiet the noises. Cause again, they want to reduce that arousal rate and they just want to feel calm before the start. I think that's
really cool. And I honestly think Formula One or, you know, racing in general might be one of the few sports where you can actually create that bubble for yourself. Downhill skiing maybe or something where you have a helmet. So I think when you don't have that opportunity that headphones can create that. Because that's the other thing Michael Phelps did. It was headphones on and hoodie up. He had his hoodie over his head. So yeah, really similar. Yeah, just all about shutting out the noise and finding your focus. Yeah, yeah. So that's cool about Formula One, though. I started to watch that series. I haven't watched all of them yet, but it was really interesting.
I would say season 3 or 4 are the best ones.
Okay. All right.
Cool. So it's really fascinating to know that music helps in many ways: associate, disassociate, reducing perceptions, effort, sometimes and making it more enjoyable. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the exercise, like you said, with lower intensity running is better for. Yeah. So is there an ideal type of music for a certain type of exercise? So if someone's going to lift or if someone's going to cycle, or have you found in the research or within through your research, if there's an ideal song to listen to or an ideal playlist to make?
The one thing I would say, I always give parameters. Like, I can talk potentially about ideal tempo, ideal sort of emotion, but I think the ideal type is always what you like. And music is so personal, right? So I never say this is an ideal song, because even though for most people, it might work really well, we have different tastes. But yeah, I think definitely when it comes to, so as I said, the vast majority of research has been done on sort of steady state cardio. Mm-hmm. And there, it seems like the ideal tempo is usually around 120 to 140 beats per minute. So there's been various studies that have looked at a whole array of tempos, and that one almost always turns out to be optimal. So that tempo range seems to be ideal for cardio. I think in terms of resistance training is really interesting because... Mm-hmm. A, you've got that, typically you want that higher arousal level because it's more explosive, but it's also not as rhythmical. So one of the reasons why 120 to 140 is so popular is because it matches sort of the stride cycle, or if you're on a bike, you know, matches your kind of RPMs. And so that is less important in weightlifting or resistance training. So what tends to be more important there is like a heavy beat. So people tend to prefer rap, hip hop, that type of music tends to be better, rock music even, for resistance training. And it's less about the tempo and more about the aggression of the song or like the emotion of the song. Lyrics are interesting. So lyrics in cardio, especially like steady state, low intensity, the lyrics are one way that people can dissociate, right? So like how you said, you can kind of distract yourself. You're singing along, especially if you're doing tedious training. Like, you know, if you're training for a marathon and you're going on like a 16-mile run and you're going pretty slow, half the time it's just pretty boring, right? You just want to stop to get it over with. And so people will sing along. And so the lyrics can be pretty powerful there. When it comes to resistance training, it's more about lyrics that make you feel a certain way. So like I said, rap music has a lot of aggressive lyrics, a lot of sort of, putting yourself, I'm superior to you kind of thing. I'm trying to quote rap lyrics without swearing.
I'll encourage it. This would be cool to see my advisor.
And so I think the lyrical content may be equally important, but is used differently. You've also got to consider movement complexity and potentially the skill level too. So, you know, a more complex lift, let's say something like a clean and jerk or something like that, you may need to attend more to the movement patterns. So you may want a less complex, so, you know, maybe a simpler rhythm, a simpler lyrical content. And especially if you're a novice as well, if you're a novice trying to learn a skill like that. Whereas, for most people, running is about as basic as it gets, you know, it's just left, right. So you can, you know, you can listen to more complex music and something that actually, this is going off topic, but one of the things I often get asked about is podcasts or audiobooks. And the one thing that I personally don't think that they are as valuable as music, because they lack some of that other content in terms of the synchronicity and the emotional valence that's construed, but they definitely have the same effect in terms of the dissociation. And so if that's what floats your boat, I think it's great. But that would be one where I can't see somebody resistance training or weightlifting and listening to an audiobook. They do. Maybe one of your viewers is going to come and tell me that's exactly what I do, and I'll be completely wrong. But yeah, I think it still has that distractive element to it. Yeah. But I think for more complex tasks, you want something pretty simple beat.
It's really funny that you mentioned podcasts. I don't listen to podcasts, but whenever I fall out of working out and I want to get myself back in, I need to make it fun for myself. So the way I do that, it's not podcasts. I listen to TV shows that I'll have The Office or Brooklyn Nine-Nine playing in my headphones. I know all the episodes. So it's a way to, again, disassociate. And I won't lift heavy. It's just about getting in the gym and going through the motions.
Yeah.
So then I've got something fun, or maybe sometimes it will be a podcast, because then it's like, all right, I'm getting some learning done while I'm also working out. So like you said, it's really about what you're trying to get out of it. If you're trying to disassociate.
That's fascinating. I could probably do that with Friends. I think I've seen every single episode of Friends so many times that I could do that. Yeah. But I've never heard about that. I actually had so you met Dolores Christiansen, right, when she was here for the ASK conference.
Cool. Yeah.
So when she was a student here, I remember she was training for an ultra marathon. And I would see her during the winter. She'd be training on a treadmill. And again, can't think of much worse than training.
Treadmill. Oh my Lord.
Training for an ultra. Yeah. But she used to bring her iPad and she used to watch movies. And I remember talking to her about it once. And she said, there's only certain types of movies I can watch. So she watched a lot of action movies where things are like blowing up and, you know, that kind of stuff. She's like, I can't follow any kind of sort of highbrow if it has a plot or a lot of dialogue, I can't follow it. So I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, she used to watch, like the Fast and the Furious or some kind of action movie while she was running on the treadmill. But I thought it was really interesting because I think there is that level of, anything that requires too much of your attention, if it has a really complicated plot, you're not going to follow it while you're running. So
yeah, that's really fascinating. so if we're thinking about it in terms of protocols, right? Like there's no correct one. But let's say the listeners are trying to put together, like we can dub it like the performance playlist, right? If I'm understanding correctly, if let's say I'm creating a playlist for myself and I'm going out on a long run, which is something I've been doing lately.
Yeah.
The first question I need to ask myself is, do I like the music that I'm going to be listening to? Or actually, I guess we could even take a step back if it comes to choosing the music, because I like sad songs and happy songs. It's what's the feeling I want to get during this run? So you create the feeling. Let's say I want to feel just motivated. I pick certain songs that make me feel that way. And then, like you said, 120 to 140 is sort of that sweet spot. Where you can go up and down from there. So like sometimes for my pace runs, I'll listen to The Strokes because they're my favorite band. And they always get me just on a nice little beats. Just, it makes you want to keep running faster. And then from there, you sort of just go into whether you want to disassociate or associate, and you can craft, like, I know at the end of my run, I want to end it on a sprint, add in certain songs, and then that's how you sort of craft it. But it all starts with, how do you actually want to feel and get out of this workout?
You absolutely nailed it, Karan. You don't even need me. You nailed it. That's exactly that's exactly what you do. So people who, again, I might offend some people here, but people who just throw it on shuffle and go, I don't know how you live like that. I don't know how you live that way. Like I am very, very anal about this. So So I think what I would do is, I'd initially start. So I might even start my playlist when I'm getting ready to go. And I know you and I have talked about this before in terms of like getting yourself in the mood even, right? So I'm sitting on my couch. It doesn't look very warm outside. I'm like, I might throw on something poppy, like a little Katy Perry, a little light and poppy, and try to get me moving. I put my sneakers on and whatever. And then again, this is going to be individual, so different people's experience would be different. But for me, starting the run is not the most pleasant thing because, you know, until you get into your flow. So I usually start with one of my favorite songs, and then then I usually do something where it's all about the beat. So often it's instrumental or it's like a remix of a song. I listen to a lot of remixes of songs where it's been extended and it has a more steady beat. So I'll do that to get myself going. And then, if I'm going to be really, really planned about it, I might even know where the hills come, the uphills and the downhills. So I might do a slightly slower track for an uphill, slightly faster when I know I'm going to be going downhill. But then, you always, towards the end, you've got your power song where you really want to kick it home. You save your best songs, I would say, for the last, maybe the last two or three songs should be the ones that really, really fire you up. Because if you use those too early, you risk going out too fast. In fact, I remember, I've only ran one marathon in my life. It was a one and done bucket list for me. I had no intention of doing it again. But when I did it, I set up my playlist. So the first song, it was actually a Coldplay song, the, what's it called? Sky Full of Stars. Yeah, it's a great song, but it's not like super fired up. It was more like groovy, you know. And so what I wanted to do, and what I knew people do when they're in a big road race, is go out too fast, because they go out with a crowd. You know, then you've got the crowd, you got people cheering, and I knew if I started too fast, things wouldn't go well for me. So I had something like that, pretty chilled for the first mile or so. And then I got into some songs where, it was more about the tempo and the pace. Some of them were instrumental, some of them were like dance music, just kind of about the pace. And then something I did, which I actually didn't anticipate doing this, but I turned the music off from about, I want to say about like mile 12 to about mile 16, because I wanted the effect of it. I didn't want to become desensitized. And so I didn't want to be like, oh, you know, this isn't helping anymore. So I ran without it for a few miles, so that when I knew, you know, when I got towards the really tough part, that I would need it again.
It's what people do with caffeine. I want to make sure it still works the days I need it to work. Let's step away from
that's
it.
Right. Yeah, you can't overdo it. You can't build up a tolerance, right? It's not and so then I did that. And then what I thought I would want, like a power song for the end, I actually ended up skipping it and going to something much more low key, because it was more of an emotional moment for me. Like, oh my God, I did it.
26 miles.
But certainly shorter races, like when I used to do a lot of 10Ks back in the day, I would always have, the last two songs were like my like go time song. So I think, that's the way you can apply the science to this. Again, within your own personal preferences, how you like to feel, songs that have meaning to you. I know we touched upon this a little bit, but, you know, songs, one of the ways they evoke emotions is often they're tied to important memories for us. So if you have a song, you know, that's like, I don't know, like a song that you associate with a happy time in your life, or a song that makes you think of a friend or something like that. Yeah. Then those things are so personal, but they're so important to account for.
I have the perfect example for this. So I think one of the reasons why I want to ask you about this was when I was training for my triathlon, I remember like after a whole day's of work, like, you know, it's 9 to 3, then I go to the gym, or sometimes you got other stuff in the middle and you're drained. And the last thing I want to do is to go in and swim for a few hours. And then right after that, go bike for a few more hours. So there would be a lot of times where me and my car in the parking lot would just be there and exist for 45 minutes, just hyping myself up. So during those moments, I essentially kind of, I was like, all right, maybe what needs to happen is I need to give myself like a theme song for all of this.
Okay.
So there's this great, like I said, I love instrumental. So it's this instrumental by this band called the Mighty Rio Grande. And it's like an electric guitar. And if you've seen the movie Moneyball, a lot of their music from that album is in that, which is where I got the song from. And I would just sit in my car and invoke, and I would just like imagine like what would it feel like if I actually trained and got to the end of this triathlon, how would it feel? And it evoked it because it's a very slowy song, and it like it allows you to ruminate and daydream almost. So I'd sit in the car sometimes up to 45 minutes just listening to like one section of it on repeat. YouTube coincidentally created like a 45 minute playlist of it on repeat, that same section. And then it would get me into the gym. So recently when I've been training, because I'm currently training for an ultra as well. That was a whim of decision. I did not feel like going on a run last weekend. So I was like, you know what? We have to go. And I turned on that song and the same script. Like, all right, what would happen if I did actually go? Because like it's tied to that memory of like, I got this triathlon done. This song reminds me of it.
Yeah.
And it got me out the door, and I'm sure I'll be using it multiple times.
That's crazy. Yeah. So that's really interesting. You use so many mental techniques there, right? So you've invoked imagery, right? And you've brought in self-efficacy, like, and you did all that before you even got into your grad program. That's it. So you're a natural. I think, you know, in terms of the way, particularly in terms of the way athletes use music, but I think exercisers can leverage this as well. Athletes obviously don't often have the luxury of being able to listen to music while they compete. Right. Mm-hmm. So there it's all about pre-warm-up music and things like that. And most of the research in exercise, because exercise typically can be done with music, is during. But I think that the bit before can be so powerful. I love how you leverage that. But then to come back to it and remember that association is also very typical, because we know that music can lock in a memory. And again, with my marathon experience, I think the song that I listened to right at the end was Glitter in the Air by Pink. You know that one?
Yes, I do. That's a good song. Which is
it's a great song.
Dr. Hutch, yeah.
But not one that I would ever run to usually. Like I wouldn't, it's not a song that I'd listen to and think, ooh, I want to run to this, you know? But it just happened to come on. Because I was skipping my, like I said, my power fast songs were not doing it for me at the end. I was like, I'm not there. Yeah. I'm not sprinting. And so I kind of stumbled across that one. But to this day, so I ran the marathon, I think it was 2013. So just over 10 years ago. And to this day, when I hear that song, it takes me back to that moment.
Yeah. I think people are going to listen to this and be like, wow, she's a cool researcher. Oh my God. She's got amazing. They need to hear your playlist. It's going to be one of the biggest takeaways. Like, where is Dr. Hutchinson's Spotify and can I find these playlists? Katy Perry.
It's super eclectic as well, because sometimes I listen to like DMX or Eminem and stuff like that, which again, I'm probably
from
not
Detroit.
In
Eminem has
Eminem is my favorite by far. But yeah, like I don't think I'm probably in like DMX's typical demographic, you know, like a middle-aged white woman. So I think if you heard what I was listening to, it just shows how music is for everybody, man. But yeah, I have gone from like some hardcore rap to like Taylor Swift within a playlist. And I'm like, wow, I'm all over the place, but it's what works, right?
Exactly. And I think you had mentioned that a lot of this stuff, I didn't really know it. It was more so intuitive. And I appreciate all the kind words. I think people do it naturally. It's just never intentionally. A lot of sports psych, whether it's self-talk, it's imagery, people do it often. Like if you like someone, you're going to spend a long time daydreaming about how you're going to go and talk to them. We do it intuitively, just in a sporting context where we say you should do that intentionally. I guess because it's a new field, people go, oh no, that's manifesting. It's pseudoscience. It's tied to that. When in reality, there's good research backing it up. And I think people need to start being intentional about it. And that's when they can use it to their advantage. And that's where I got lucky that I hit something.
Yeah. You know, I absolutely love that. I'm going to have to steal that. I'll give you credit, but yeah, do it naturally, but not intentionally explains so much, because I know just when I was starting out in this field, when I was getting my PhD and I almost felt like a bit like, a fraud or something, because, you know, I'd go and talk to athletes and I'm like, I'm sure you already do. If you're an elite athlete and you've never used self-talk, I'll be shocked. You know what I mean? So I used to feel like, what exactly am I bringing here? And then I realized they don't, not many use it intentionally. Like they don't have a systematic approach. And so I think it's very similar with music. Yeah. I think you really hit on it there. I think everybody naturally, you know, you don't need a PhD to know that music helps when you work out. Right. But I think it's that scientific application and the intentionality that's really what we develop when we study this. So that's a really nice way of phrasing it.
I appreciate that. I think that goes into the next part where I wanted to essentially, people hear all this stuff and it's really great, but they don't know how to apply it, right? Protocols are something we talked about, but I think people need to learn how to experiment, which is what I had written in our little document that said like how to think like a scientist. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite authors, Adam Grant, he wrote the book Give and Take and Originals. Those are always on bookshelves at Barnes and Nobles. But he had said there are four types of thinkers. He said there's preachers, politicians, prosecutors, and then the last ones are scientists. Preachers, essentially, you can think salesmen. They believe something is right, so they're going to try to convince you of it. They're preaching. Then there's politicians who are more on, I mean, as the name suggests, right? They're trying to win you over with something, gain approval, but they might not actually be saying what they feel. And lastly, you've got, or thirdly, you've got prosecutors who want to find out, hey, you're saying something wrong and I want to prove myself right, but by pointing you, pointing these things out.
Okay.
All these have their pros and cons, but then the last one is scientists, where it's not about proving something right or wrong. It's seeing what you're right and wrong about. There's this combination of humility with curiosity. And I think that's why most people sometimes don't appreciate sports psych, is because it's a very abstract concept. Mm-hmm. And if you don't test it right or enough times and you don't get it instantly, people go, see, it doesn't work.
Right.
And they need to, I guess people, myself included, need to learn how to experiment with it, be wrong, and see what they can tinker with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I mean, you've been in this field for a while. You train researchers like myself and many others. How can people think like scientists?
Yeah, I think that's exactly, it's a really interesting anecdote. I hadn't heard about the type of thinkers before. It's pretty cool. But yeah, I think thinking like a scientist starts from not thinking that you know everything. You have to be really, really humble. And one of the things that I actually feel like I do to students when they study with me, especially at the doctoral level, is I want you to walk out of here feeling like you knew less than when you walked in, because what I want you to realize is we don't know everything and we will always be trying to test new hypotheses, test new ideas, always. That's how you get better. So I think, yeah, especially at the doctoral level, people might come in, they're like, oh, I already got a master's degree in this. I already kind of know this. And my goal is like, you don't know anything. because I think that is how you think like a scientist. I think you have to be curious. You have to be constantly coming up with ideas and testing them and refining them. And honestly, when you get into that mindset, it's almost like a sickness. That's what I'm like with everything. Yeah. Like I honestly, I'm so, what's the word? I'm so skeptical about so many things. And I think it's because I have to look at it for myself, right? So I have to be like, well, that's interesting. Let me go check the science on this and let me look into this. You know, I don't typically take things at face value. And so, I think curiosity, going back to Ted Lasso, right? I think that's that's number one. And then the air of humility, the idea that we're never going to be true experts. We're always learning.
Yeah. Two things that come to mind when you said you want to make them feel like they know less. Have you seen the Dunning-Kruger effect? I believe that's what it's called.
Oh, yeah. It's like, how does it go again? Remind me. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So the graph essentially is, if I get this right, on the y-axis, it's confidence about a certain topic. And then on the x-axis is how much time you spend studying it.
Oh,
and it shows
great.
That the people who have studied, like the curve essentially is like an up with a nice steep downhill, and then it's like a nice big basin that goes back up again or starts veering up. And what it essentially means is that people who have very little information feel like they're very confident about something.
Right.
Because they exactly get the base level and then you learn more. It's like, holy crap, like you said, I don't know shit. And then as you spend more time, things starts clicking together. And that's where, like you said, thinking like a scientist is good, because this is another conversation, but we're always stuck in echo chambers with social media.
Mm.
You know, we subscribe to the same things we always want to hear. So thinking like a scientist is not just about experimentation. It's about just making through all this information that we always get loaded onto us. It's like, how can you figure out what's there?
You know what? I thought about social media, because I thought how much we take things at face value, especially when things are designed that way, right? So you're right. You surround yourself with what you already know, or like what you already believe in. So then you've got the confirmation bias working right there. You seek out things that reinforce your existing views. But then also it's packaged in a way that you don't question it, because it's like a 30-second reel, right? It's not designed for you to take a deep dive. You watch it and you scroll and you move on, and you take it at face value for sure. So I almost feel like with this generation and the fact that people have grown up with this and social media is becoming ever more invasive, I almost feel like this should be a class, like a high school class on, like, you know, questioning or critical thinking or something, you know?
So, I'm surprised critical thinking isn't a course, because I mean that now that's
what, I mean it's ideally weaved throughout many courses, right? But I think maybe a class on like social media consumption and critical thinking or something like that, I think would be, it would be great because that really plays into that Dunning-Kruger effect, right? I saw a 30-second reel on something. I think I know what it's about. And I'm, I do not.
As you know, right now, since you're my chair, I'm doing my research on self-talk and a lot of what I see. And again, I'm actually, because I've created content, a part of this problem in a way, where it's like, oh, if you have negative self-talk, the only solution is positive self-talk.
Right.
And when you look through the research, there's a lot more to it than that. Negative self-talk still has its place. And I was like confident about it to the point where I'll put out something saying, hey, this is the way. But now that I do, it's like, whoa, hold up. No, that was not right. And it's fascinating. And that's the best part because it gives you answers and things make more sense. It's not absolute, it's malleable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. We covered so much good stuff. Another thing, one thing I definitely wanted to ask you was for trainers, I guess we also sort of touched on this with, so were you a personal trainer? I feel like you mentioned at one point you didn't.
Yeah.
When you're crafting a playlist, right, you're working with gym goers, and now we're talking more about resistance training in the gym. If you're crafting a playlist, what sort of things, because it's resistance exercise, should they keep in mind when they're crafting a playlist for, let's say, novice people or just people that have always been there and they do know this crew has been lifting for a while versus these seven people are coming in for the first time?
Honestly, I think crafting a playlist for a group setting is one of the hardest things you could possibly do. I know Dr. Brian Thompson has asked me a lot because he's our head strength and conditioning coach and director. And he asked me all the time, what should I play in the weight room? And I'm like, oh man, that's a loaded question right now. I got no idea. I think, you know, if you're in small group training where you may have a mix of ages, let's say, it's really difficult. But I think in those situations, I would just, I would avoid extremes, right? So let's say some people might love heavy metal. Some people might love country, things like, but some people really don't, you know? So honestly, I would, it sounds like a really lame answer, but I would kind of go top 40, pretty standard stuff that nobody has like a really horrible reaction to. And I think if you're working with the same group, building that sense of, you know, if you have the same music, I know people think they need to mix it up to keep people interested, but actually listening to the same track over and over again, you actually build, you could start to build that sense of like, oh, I remember this song. Like I remember the last time and, you know, I was, you know, trying to keep up with you and you know, so, and then, you know, you can ask people personal preferences. I think one-on-one training is a little different because one-on-one training tends to be a lot more conversational, right? You're talking to the person, you're cueing them. So, you know, the music, if at all, it'll be background music. You know, it's not going to be as loud. But again, has something happy, something upbeat. Surprisingly enough, like there's an idea that exercise makes you feel good. Exercise makes you feel good when it's over. Actually, not many people enjoy exercise. And so you really want to try to manipulate that. We all get that feel better effect afterwards when we're stretching and we're like, yeah, I did it. But if you ask somebody in the middle of it, they're like, this sucks. I don't want to be here. So I think, you know, positive emotion, happy lyrics, empowering lyrics would probably be my go-to. But yeah, I think that's one of the most difficult, playlist to craft is when it's for more than one person because it's so individual.
That was one of the hardest part for me. It's like when you're personal training at a big gym, sometimes you just have the workouts given to you and you're just going in to train. So I've seen so many other trainers that I've trained with who are intentional about their music because they know, all right, I know Jasmine, I know I'm using Kathleen just because you're a professor. Yep. Those are the names that come to my mind. They really like, you know, the Black Eyed Peas.
Right.
She works that into the songs, but she'll put it when she knows that they're pushing at their max because the workout is lined up for 50 minutes. So it's like, all right, near the end or when we're doing squats, I know she really likes it. She's intentional about it. And I thought it was so cool to see the other trainers do that. And it's really, what does a crowd like? How do you want them to feel going into the workout? As you said, aggression is better for
something else
training.
That actually that just made me think of something, which is when you're looking at age, people tend to have the strongest association with music from their most formative years, which tends to be late teens through early adulthood. And so whatever, so like I did a music intervention in a diabetes outpatient clinic where the average age was about 60 years old. And so that was something I had to bear in mind too. And so I would sprinkle in some up-to-date songs that might currently be on the radio. But a lot of what I dug into was stuff that they would have listened to, you know, in their 20s. And And it's funny, actually, because I really appreciate that you knew every song I threw at you when I was talking about like DMX and Eminem and even Pink to a certain extent. I mean, she's still around, but
She's from Michigan, actually.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's absolutely amazing. But I still, a lot of those songs that I listened to when I was in college, there's just the memories and just a great time in your life and, you know, a time of, and that's another thing to consider if you're doing a playlist in a personal training setting is the age of the athletes as well. So
that's awesome. I think there's so much that I feel like people have gone from this, and this is a perfect timing. We're at 59 minutes and our goal is an hour. Time flies when you talk about music and awesome stuff like this. And I'm not going to lie, there's still countless more I want to talk about, but obviously we want to keep it concise. So I'll end it with this one last question. If there was one main takeaway you wanted to give to individuals, whether it's about support psych, music, performance psychology, anything, what would that takeaway be?
Whew, man.
Loaded question.
Right? I think I'm going to go in order. I'm going to go in order of this podcast. I'm going to say, listen to Taylor Swift. Be intentional, think like a scientist, and question everything. Because I feel like that's where our conversation went. So, but I think the be intentional is the biggest piece that I think is a really good takeaway. You know, how we hit on. And I think if you really want to leverage the power of music in your own sport or exercise environment, that I think being intentional with how you use it and experimenting and learning is the way to do it. Don't press shuffle.
Don't press shuffle. This is the official, like, we need to go to Spotify, send them a letter.
Yeah.
Dr. Hutchinson, this was so awesome. Thank you so much for coming on this episode. This was, honestly, I had so much fun talking about it where it felt like 20 minutes.
Oh, this was great. Yeah, honestly, thank you for the invite. I love talking about this. We probably could have filled 2 hours, but maybe nobody but us would want to listen to it, but it was great.
I'll make sure the students in our cohort listen to it. There'll be a little bit of a, I'll make them incentivized.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the invite. Perfect.